Purim suffers from being very popular with children. What I mean by that is, because it's so popular with children, and because so much of our emphasis is on children enjoying themselves on Purim, which is important, we often lose sight of the fact that it is a very adult holiday with very sophisticated themes. And it's not just recalling a historical episode that happened 2400 years ago. It is actually the clash of two different worldviews. And the way the clash works out, it defines one of the essential, fundamental principles of Judaism. And it also contains a lesson, maybe the lesson, about how we should go about confronting challenges in our own lives. And that's the reason it's one of our holy days. It's one of our holy days because it teaches us something fundamental, and it allows us to grow by experiencing the way that we observe it. So what I want to do with you this evening is to look at the holiday and to look at the way we celebrate it and to be able to figure out what is the gift that is being offered to us when we observe Purim. Purim is one chapter in a very long battle between the people of Israel and the people of Amalek. The people of Amalek were an ancient people that lived in the southwest part of Israel. In the Purim story, Haman, who is the character that comes up with the plan to wipe out all of the Jews, Haman is identified as an offspring of this people. So Purim is one installment in the story. But let's start at the very beginning. The battle, the original battle between the Jewish people and the people of Amalek. And in fact, this passage, which I want to look with you on the first page of the booklet, we are going to read this passage in the synagogue this coming Shabbos. This coming Shabbos is the Shabbos before Purim, and it is called the Shabbos of Parshas Zachar, the reading the portion of Zachar, which means remember, which is the first word of the paragraph. It's at the top of the page. And the reason that we read this paragraph is because of the connection between this paragraph and the holiday of Purim that comes next week. So if you look at the top of the page, Zachar es asher asolucha Amalek, remember what Amalek did to you on your way out of Egypt. So this is just a few days after the Jews left Egypt, and they went through the desert, and the sea split for them, and finally they're free. And just a few days later, they are attacked. And they are attacked for no reason. They were not a threat to anyone. They were not encroaching on anyone's territory. And the attack was not an honorable attack. When they encountered you on the way, and you were tired and exhausted, they cut off those lagging to your rear, and they did not fear God. So they attacked from behind. Our sages tell us they attacked the women and the children. They attacked the vulnerable. It was not an honorable war between armies. It was a vicious, evil attack, unprovoked, for no reason. Therefore, the Torah continues, when God gives you peace from all your enemies, etc., you must obliterate the memory of Amalek from under the heavens. You must not forget. So there are two parts to the obligation. Number one, we're required to remember Zohar, remember, V'al Tishkach, and do not forget what Amalek did to us. There is such a thing as essential evil, pure evil in the world. So do not forget. And that's why we have an obligation at least once a year to read this paragraph out loud in public in the synagogue. And also there will come some future time when we will have an obligation to obliterate, to wipe out the memory of Amalek, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. Because Haman is a descendant of Amalek, so when Haman comes up with a decree to wipe out the Jews, it is simply another installment of Amalek's attempt to attack the Jews for no reason with utter cruelty. So that's the connection between the portion and Purim. If you look, please, one more time at the top of the page, I read it to you in English. And I read to you, remember what Amalek did to you on your way out of Egypt, when they encountered you on the way. The English translation is not so precise. If you look at the Hebrew, the second line, the Hebrew is, Asher karcha baderech. Karcha, which is translated here as they encountered you on the way. The word karcha implies they encountered by means of coincidence. They just happened to be there. It wasn't part of a plan, just coincidentally they happened to be there and they attacked. So our sages say, what does that mean, they coincidentally happened to be there? Our sages say that the characteristic of Amalek is a characteristic that stands in diametric opposition to the characteristic of the Jewish people. The characteristic of Amalek is to see the world in terms of coincidences. Let's ask the following question. Everybody knew what happened to the Jewish people. They were slaves. And God came to them, and God said, I'm going to take you out of Egypt. And God did the 10 plagues, and God split the sea. I mean, who would attack the Jewish people after all of the open, clear miracles that had just been done by God on their behalf? Who would have started up with them? The answer is, Asher Karcha, Amalek saw the world in terms of coincidences. It's a coincidence. You know, it wasn't really a miracle. There was a storm and the water, and it pushed the water, and they walked through it. It looked like dry land. And there was a plague, and there was a famine, and it was coincidences. There are lots of coincidences that piled up, but there's nothing inherently meaningful about what happened to the Jewish people, and therefore we can attack them, because whatever happened was simply coincidence. The characteristic of Amalek is the characteristic of looking at the world and seeing coincidences. And that is in diametric opposition to the characteristic of the Jewish people, as I'll show you in just a moment. Haman was a descendant of Amalek. And Haman, in the Purim story, in the Megillah, Haman demonstrates the same characteristic. For example, Haman decides that he wants to kill the Jews for no reason. Again, like Amalek. So he wants to pick a date on which to carry out this plot. And the Megillah, the story of Esther, tells us that he used a lottery. He used a lottery and picked a month, and then in the month picked the day, and picked this day in Adar, which is coming up next week. In other words, Haman's plan related to coincidence. There's no order, it's random. How do you come up with a date? It's random. And in fact, that's the name of the holiday. The word Purim is plural of the singular Pur. Pur means a lottery. So Purim is the story of the lotteries. In other words, Purim is the story of a person who uses coincidences. That was Haman's approach. And in fact, the entire story can be looked at as a series of coincidences. Let's review the story. The story starts with Ahasuerus, who's married to a queen. King Ahasuerus is married to Queen Vashti, and he gets upset with her, and he has her killed. Kind of an unusual thing, okay? He has her killed, so then it follows he needs a new queen. So he has a beauty contest, And lo and behold, the woman who wins the contest happens to be Esther, the niece of Mordechai. And it just so happens that she doesn't tell anyone that she is Jewish. She keeps that a secret. And it just so happens that Mordechai overhears a plot to assassinate Ahasuerus and informs on the plot and ingratiates himself to the king. And it just so happens that all of a sudden Haman, for no reason, decides to come up with his plan to wipe out all the Jews. And it just so happens that Esther is the only person who would be able to have some kind of an effect, because she's now inside the palace and nobody knows that she's Jewish, so she has this credibility. But it's only because of all these coincidences of how she happened to get there. And then it just so happens that one night Ahasuerus can't sleep, and he has the records read to him aloud, and it just so happens the record that is read is that Mordechai had saved his life, and Mordechai had not been rewarded for it. And it just so happens that the reward that Mordechai chooses is a reward that has him be publicized through the city. And it just so happens that when Haman wants to discuss his plot to kill all the Jews, just at that moment, Esther reveals herself as being a Jewish person, and therefore one of the people that's going to get killed by Haman. And it just so happens that Ahasuerus decides that instead of killing the Jews, Ahasuerus will kill Haman. If you look at the story, the entire story is a series of one coincidence after another. Hold on. That's exactly what I'm coming to. Hold on. What I mean is, the story on one level can be looked at as purely coincidence, and that's one level of the meaning of calling the holiday of Purim. And that is the level at which Haman views the world. In fact, of all of the books of the Bible, the story of Esther, Megillas Esther, the book of Esther is the only book in which God's name does not appear. Because the truth is, you don't see any clear, overt miracles. All you see are these coincidences. And the Talmud says an amazing thing. The Talmud says, what is the hint to Esther in the Torah? Now, first we have to understand the question. The question is a double question. The first part of the question is, Esther, what does the word mean? And where in the Torah, in the five books of Moses, is there some hint to the meaning of the name of Esther? And, in a wider sense, the story of what happened to Esther, where in the five books of Moses is that story alluded to? And the Talmud says, please look on the second page, in the book of Deuteronomy, near the end of the five books of the Torah, near the bottom of the page, verse 18, V'anochi, and God says to the Jewish people, Haster astir ponai bayomahu. God says, on that day, I will hide my face. I will appear to you as if I am invisible to you. I will run the world in a way that will make it appear that I'm not present. And of course, we know God is talking about our time, for sure. And there's certainly many other times that Jews would say the same thing. The word haster, astir, I will surely hide, is the same root word as the word Esther. Esther means something that is hidden. Well, of course, someone who is hidden, she hid her identity. But it also parallels the fact that in the story of Esther, God is hidden. There does not appear on the surface to be any plan. Everything appears to be random. Everything appears to be coincidence. And the truth is that for many of us, except for those of us who were here last week, but for many of us, that's how the world appears to us. we go through our daily lives and we don't see God. We don't sense God. What happens, we ascribe to chance because we have no other way to explain it. So the only way to explain it is it's got to be random. And it could be minor things, it could be terrible things. So we say, you know, it's a coincidence. Things happen, and it happened. Because there's nothing that helps us come up with an explanation, because God is hidden. Part of the fascination people today have with lotteries and lottery tickets and gambling in general has to do with a fascination with coincidence, with random. Because, you know, anything can happen. Anybody could win. It's completely coincidence. Let's now take a wider look. Because when you read the whole book of Esther, yes, there is no clear divine intervention. And every person in the story is exercising their own free choice. No one is being forced or manipulated into anything. And yet, when you see the story, it becomes clear that there is a plan. That everything that happens, happens for a reason. And keep in mind, the events of the Megillas Esther occur over 9 years. And a person who is living through them may very well not have seen that pattern as they were living through it. But when you step back and you see the whole story and you hear it read in a half hour, it's clear that there's a plan. It's clear in retrospect that there was a reason that Ahasuerus killed Vashti, and there was a reason that Esther hid her identity, etc., etc., etc. Everything is part of a plan. And when you look at the whole story with that kind of a view, it is clear that God is present. Sometimes we'll be able to see what God's plan is, at least in retrospect. Sometimes we will not be able to see. You're absolutely right. Sometimes we will not be able to see it. But that is fundamentally different than saying there is no plan. That's the point I want to make. And that is a fundamental Jewish belief. And that belief is that God created heaven and earth. And when God creates heaven and earth, God did not simply make it and leave it alone to run on its own. God remains involved with what happens in this world. Everyone has freedom of choice. Everyone can act as they see fit. But there is a general plan. There is no such thing as a coincidence. And that is a fundamental Jewish teaching. And that is what Purim is coming to teach us. Purim is coming to teach us that in spite of the way the world may look to our eyes, in fact there is a plan. Sometimes we may never see it. Sometimes we may never understand it. Sometimes we may have to wait a number of years to be able to look back and see, now I understand, or I think I understand, why this happened and why that happened. And sometimes I will never be able to understand. But the fact is, there is a plan. In other words, Purim is about searching for what is below the surface. Purim is about not being willing to accept the fact that everything that happens in the world is random. Purim is about being willing to look below the surface to try to see what the plan is. And even if I can't see what the plan is, at least to remind myself that there is a plan, and maybe one day I will see it. Maybe one day I won't, but maybe one day I will. And a plan exists. And that's what I mean when I say Purim is about a clash between two different ways of looking at the world. It is a way of looking at the world like Amalek versus looking at the world like the Jewish people. That's the clash. So the reason we have a holiday of Purim is not just because we were in big trouble and we were saved from trouble and it was a very important event. the reason we celebrate the holiday of Purim every year is because it gives us an opportunity to remind ourselves about a fundamental aspect of how we're supposed to look at the world. And the way that we celebrate Purim, every detail of how we celebrate Purim is intended to reinforce that message. Let me describe it to you. There are two principal methods of observing Purim. The first is to celebrate, to rejoice, to be happy, to show our gratitude and thanks to God for what He did for us in the past, and many other times in history when the Jewish people were saved from being wiped out. And that means being grateful and thankful for a miracle that doesn't appear to us to be a miracle. Because remember, there is no overt, clear miracle like the splitting of the Red Sea in the story of the Megillah. So in other words, what we're training ourselves to do is, we're training ourselves to be able to see there's a miracle like the splitting of the Red Sea, and then there's another type of miracle. The type of miracle where a person wakes up each morning. And the fact that a person wakes up each morning is no less a miracle than the splitting of the Red Sea. The only difference is, since it happens to us every day, we get used to it. And we think, we call it nature. We call it natural. We expect it. But it's no less miraculous. It's only repeated. And so Purim causes us to celebrate, to say thank you, God, not only for the once-in-a-lifetime events, but for the everyday gifts and miracles that God bestows upon us. So that's the first aspect, is to celebrate. And one of the ways that we do that is on Purim Day, this Tuesday, we have a Purim Seuda, a festive meal, where we celebrate, and we eat, and we enjoy each other's company, we have a great time. To celebrate and to say thank you for God for all the miracles that He does. That's one way to celebrate. That's one way to observe the holiday. The second way, the second primary way that we observe the holiday is by publicizing the miracle. By reading the Megillah, or by hearing the Megillah read aloud in public. Our sages tell us that the reason that we read the Megillah aloud, why don't we just, you know, everybody take 15 minutes and read it to yourself and, you know, we'll discuss it afterwards. No, we read it aloud. Why do we read it aloud? Because we want to publicize the miracle. Publicizing the miracle is the essential mitzvah of the day of Purim. Why? Because the whole point of having the holiday is to publicize that this, in fact, is a miracle. That's why that's the mitzvah. And we read the Megillah. It's interesting that according to Jewish law, we are required to read or hear the Megillah read twice. Once in the evening, this year on Monday night, and again during the day on Tuesday morning. The day before Purim, Monday during the day, is a fast day. It's called Tainis Esther, the fast day of Esther, and I'm going to come back to this in just a couple of minutes. But if you think about it, the first time we read the Megillah on Monday night, we are reading it while we are still fasting. It's still part of the day of the fast. And traditionally, we only break our fast after we hear the Megillah. So the first time we read the Megillah, we're really reading it from the point of view of fasting and sadness and vulnerability. The second time we read it, on Tuesday morning, on Purim Day, we've been celebrating. We're happy. We're rejoicing. Purim is a happy day. So we read it twice. Once to emphasize the danger, and the second time to emphasize the triumph. Because there really are two parts to the story. On the one hand, we were in big trouble. There was a decree to wipe out all the Jewish people. On the other hand, we were saved from that decree. So we actually read it twice to publicize both aspects of that miracle, the danger and the triumph. There is a custom in many synagogues that when the Megillah is read aloud, when Haman's name is read, people make noise. And they take groggers and they make noise. And that's really what attracts most of the children. And probably a lot of the adults. A fascinating source to that practice. Where does it come from? It comes from, back to the Torah portion we're going to read this week. The Torah says, Timche es Zecher Amalek. If you turn back to the front page, it's on the top paragraph, the last line in the middle, Timche es Zecher Amalek. And if you see it in the English, you must obliterate the memory of Amalek. Now, obliterate is the translation of the word timcha. You have to cause it not to appear anymore. The word timcha is related to the word for erase, which is the same thing, to remove, to make invisible. So the original custom was to take a piece of wood and on the piece of wood to draw a picture of Haman or to write the name of Haman. And then to take another piece of wood and hit it together and strike them one against the other in order to rub out, to cause the name to be erased. That is, it's a play on words. Because Haman is a descendant of Amalek, and the biblical passage talks about obliterating, meaning erasing the memory. So we do that in a literal sense, not the meaning of the phrase, but it's the literal translation of the phrase to erase the name, and that's where the custom came to make noise by hitting these blocks together when Haman's name is read. Of course, the only problem with that making noise is that every person is obligated to hear the words of the Megillah, because the whole idea is to publicize the miracle, which you can only publicize if you can hear the words. So if people are making too much noise, so there's got to be a balance somewhere between making noise on the one hand and being able to hear the words on the other hand, and different places will arrive at a consensus on that balance. But there is a special mitzvah to hear the Megillah read in a congregation, even though theoretically a person could read it by themselves, or a person could have it read to them by themselves. There is a special mitzvah to read it in public, because the mitzvah is to publicize the miracle. The more people who hear it read at any one time, the more publicity that the miracle is getting. And that's the essence of the holiday, is to publicize the fact of this miracle, because that reminds us how we're supposed to be looking at the world, and how we're supposed to be looking at the world not only in the past but in our own lives, how we're supposed to be looking at the world. So I would say that the first fundamental lesson of Purim is reviewing this fundamental teaching about the fact that nothing is coincidence, nothing is random, and to look below the surface to look for the patterns. There is a second fundamental lesson that we learn from Purim, and that is in the strategy that we, the Jewish people, use to face the danger that we faced. And that is a strategy that sets the pattern for all future events. And it goes like this. There is a single verse on the third page. This is near the middle of the story, where Haman has issued his decree that on such and such a date, the entire Jewish people will be wiped out. Mordechai finds out about it. Mordechai realizes this must be the reason why Esther is the queen, and she has hidden her identity, and now she is the only one that will have the access to be able to come before Ahasuerus and beg somehow for the decree to be rescinded. And Mordechai speaks to Esther and tells her that she has this task that she has to fulfill to save the Jewish people. And Esther responds with the following strategy. Verse 50. Vatomer Esther Lashiv El Mordechai. Esther sent a message to send back to Mordechai. Lech Kenosis Kol HaYehudim. Go and gather together all the Jews, Hanin Tzu'im B'Shushan, who are to be found in the city of Shushan, and have a fast, proclaim a fast day. Don't eat and don't drink. Of course, there'll be prayer during that time. And in the merit of the fasting and the prayer and the repentance and the coming together of every Jewish person in Shushan into one group, that merit will cause that when I go to Ahasuerus, God will see to it that it will ultimately be successful. Lech Kenosis Kol HaYehudim is the strategy for the Jewish people to respond to anything that happens to us. Gather together the Jewish people. Because when the Jewish people are gathered together, when we act with unity towards each other, that is the greatest merit, the greatest means of salvation that we have at our disposal for anything that happens to us. And it is a truism. It has been shown over and over and over again throughout Jewish history that the danger that we, the Jewish people, face is much more grave when Jews are fighting with Jews. When Jews are united, the strongest enemy has no effect on us. And when Jews are not united, when Jews are fighting with ourselves, then the weakest enemy has ultimate power over us. That's the lesson that Esther is teaching to Mordechai. That's the importance of Tainus Esther. That's why we have the fast of Esther. We don't have to do it 3 days, we only do it one day, which is thank God. But what we do, and this is very significant, on the day before Purim, so to speak, the introduction to Purim is, we relive Esther's strategy. And we remind ourselves, we have to gather together. We have to gather together in synagogues and pray together. Gather together in study halls and study together. We have to gather together and recognize that every Jew is precious. And every Jew is my brother and my sister. And that is going to be the way by which we're going to be triumphant tonight and tomorrow on Purim. How are we going to succeed? We're going to succeed because we gathered ourselves together into one unit. That's the lesson that Esther teaches us. And that's why we begin Purim with Tainus Esther, with the fast of Esther. And that's the reason, or another layer to the reason, of the special mitzvah to read the Megillah in public. Because how do you publicize the miracle? You publicize the miracle by bringing Jews together, by collecting Jews together. Yes, every one of us could go home and read the Megillah to ourselves and we would fulfill the letter of the law. That's true. But we would not have fulfilled Esther's strategy, Lech Kenosis Kol HaYehudim. And therefore, there is a special mitzvah to gather together as a group to read the Megillah, to hear the story, to hear the advice that Esther has for her and the advice that she has for us. Now, let me show you how this continues. So those are the two primary mitzvahs. The mitzvah to have a Purim Seuda, a festive meal during the day, and the mitzvah to read the Megillah aloud, preferably in public. There are a couple of other mitzvos that apply on the day of Purim. One is the mitzvah of Shalach Manos. Shalach Manos means giving gifts of food to your friends. And there's another mitzvah called Matanos Le'evyonim, giving gifts of charity to the poor. Now, it's a very nice thing to give gifts to your friends, and it's a very nice thing to give charity to the poor. But neither of those actions have anything to do with the story of Purim. There's nothing in the narrative of Purim about anybody giving gifts to each other or giving gifts to the poor. How do these become mitzvos? They become mitzvos because there's a mitzvah to have a Purim Seudah, a festive meal. Now, if Esther is right that the ultimate strategy for our triumph is when Jews gather together, it does me no good if I have a Purim Seudah by myself. It can only help if I have a Purim Seudah and I make sure that someone else has a Purim Seudah. So therefore, there's a mitzvah of Shalach Manos. And that means to give a gift of at least 2 ready-to-eat foods to at least 1 friend. The idea being, I am giving foods that can be used by my friend at their Purim Seudah. That's the idea. The idea is, I'm not only making a Purim Seudah for myself, I am at the same time making a Purim Seudah for somebody else. That's what it means, Leich Kenosis Kol HaYehudim. It means, if I'm going to celebrate, the only way I can celebrate is if you're celebrating also. And if I don't do something to help you celebrate, then I'm not really celebrating. So therefore, on Purim during the day, during Tuesday this year, there's a mitzvah of Shalach Manos, to take gifts of ready-to-eat food, to give at least 2 ready-to-eat foods to at least 1 other person, so that they will be able to enhance their Purim Seudah. Now, obviously, you can give other gifts as well, and you can add other things to it. And of course, you can choose whichever recipient you want. I'll make a suggestion. My suggestion is, when you're choosing your recipient, choose someone where you can create a new friendship, where you can make someone new your friend. Or if someone was your friend and something happened to interrupt that friendship, use that as an opportunity to repair that friendship. Because then what you're doing is really the spirit of the mitzvah. Because the spirit of the mitzvah is to... Thank you so much. I appreciate that. The spirit of the mitzvah is to bring together all Jews. In other words, yes, it's very nice to give your best friend Shalach Manos. Please don't stop giving Shalach Manos to your best friend. But use the mitzvah in a way that helps connect the entire Jewish people, like giving to someone who would not otherwise receive from anyone else, or giving to someone who others may have forgotten about, or giving to someone with whom you can thereby create a relationship to bring together the Jewish people. That's the mitzvah of Shalach Manos. And then there's also a mitzvah of Matanas Lev Yonim. Now, the mitzvah of Matanas Lev Yonim, to give gifts to the poor, really has 2 parts. The first part is on Purim day, to give a gift that would be enough to purchase at least a minimum meal for at least 2 needy people. By the way, you should be able to see that a person should spend more money and attention on Matanos Lev Yonim, gifts to the poor, than on Shalach Manos, gifts to their friends. Because in terms of priority, the gifts to the poor is more important than the gifts to the friends. They're both important, but there's a priority. So the idea is that a person who is needy, who doesn't have the money to afford a Purim Seudah, you should help them be able to afford it. So how much would it cost to give to have a minimal Purim Seudah by oneself? I don't know, $10, maybe, let's say $20. So to give that gift to 2 people who need it, that is the mitzvah of Matanas Lev Yonim. The practice is, in many places, that people will give the money on Purim morning, that is this year, Tuesday morning, For example, some people give money to me, and I have a list of people who are needy, and I give it to them anonymously, so that they don't know who's receiving it. No one who gives it knows to whom it goes. And there are other ways to give the money, and there are other organizations that collect it, and they're all good organizations. So that's one part of it. There is a second part of it, which is a very interesting rule on Purim. On Purim, the rule is, anyone who puts out his hand to ask for assistance, you should not turn down. Anyone who asks, you should give at least something. It doesn't have to be the same amount, but at least something. Now let me just explain what this means. During the year, the law is as follows. If a person asks me for charity, for tzedakah, so according to Jewish law, if they ask me for a minimal amount, let's say a quarter, that they might need for an immediate need, like food or drink, then if I have it, I am supposed to respond and give it to them without investigating, are they legitimate, do they really need it? If it is for a minimal amount, I should try to train myself to be the person to respond, whoever asks, Jew or non-Jew, whoever asks. That is the correct thing. If a person asks me for something more, if a person asks me for $100 or $10, so then I have the right to investigate first whether the need is a legitimate need. Because, of course, most people that ask for help really need it, but it just takes one bad apple to ruin it for everybody else, because everyone remembers the one story of the person who was collecting and they really, you know, they were multimillionaires and, okay. So, during the year, according to Jewish law, if a person asks me for anything beyond absolute subsistence, I have the right to investigate, are they legitimate, do they really need it? On Purim, it's different. On Purim, whoever asks, I'm supposed to open my hand without investigating first whether they are legitimate. Of course, we're talking about modest amounts. There is a practice that you'll see. Maybe you practice. On Purim, some people wear masks and some people wear costumes. A lot of people think that Purim is simply a Jewish Halloween. You know, it's fantasy and it's, you know, role-playing and it's... That's not what it is. And in fact, the masks and the costumes express the essence of Purim. Because what wearing a mask means is, don't look at what you see. Don't look at the surface. There's something that is below the surface. You have to look below the surface to see the essential truth. Don't just look at the surface and see the coincidences and just assume that God is absent. Look below the surface. The true identity of a person, like the true identity of an event, is when you search below the surface. And that is alluded to in the Megillah, when the Megillah says, "V'nahapachu," things were overturned. Things were just the opposite of what they seemed. And having those opposites, that's the source of the practice of the masks and the costumes. In fact, that's actually the source of one of the very famous foods that's associated with Purim. Many people don't know this, but in fact, these black and white cookies, this is actually a Purim food, and it represents the light and the dark, and the yes, I did. Yes, I did. But it was pretty good since.
Yeah, it sounded good, right?
Since you just bought them this afternoon, it was pretty good. One more element is that's also the idea behind the practice that some people have of drinking alcohol on Purim and getting drunk. Now, that idea has turned into by and large, a very bad idea, because many people misuse that. And many people get themselves into trouble, and especially if a person is driving, God forbid, should never ever allow such a thing. Unfortunately, there are all too many terrible tragedies that occur, and not just that, but just in terms of addictions and other kinds of negative behavior that comes from it, we don't have the ability to use it in a healthy way. But the original intention, the idea was that the state of inebriation would allow a person to feel something beyond the surface, looking beyond just the surface, getting to, so to speak, the inner person. Again, we misuse it all too often. It's a dangerous tool to use. But the idea is you're somehow opening up what is within somebody as opposed to the outer surface that they present to the rest of the world. That's what Purim is. The two ideas of Purim. Number one, God is behind the scenes, and we have to try to look for God behind the scenes, even if we don't see it, even if we don't understand it. And number two, when we are in trouble, our best strategy is to get Jews to gather together. That is the strategy that Esther teaches. And if you look at every single detail of Purim, in the way we observe it, every detail serves to express one or the other of those two main themes. And that's why Purim is a gift. Purim, to go through Purim is to receive a gift of how to look at the world more accurately and how to respond to what happens in our lives more helpfully. To go through Purim is to receive a gift of how to look at the world more accurately and how to respond to what happens in our lives more helpfully.